Thanks to Linode for their continued support of Does Not Compute. Linode is a great way to get your own virtual private servers up and running in just seconds. They've got 8 data centers spread out around the world, which makes it super easy to get your data to your users no matter where they are. You get full control over your machines, which means you can do all sorts of things with them. Run a private VPN or Git server, encrypt the disk, run Docker containers, or just about anything else you can dream up. Every Linode machine has native SSD storage and runs on Intel E5 processors over a 40 gigabit network. If you head over to linode.com/doesnotcompute and sign up using the promo code doesnotcompute2017, all one word, they'll give you $20 in account credit. Thanks again to Linode for their support, and don't forget to head over to linode.com/doesnotcompute to sign up today.
Lag. We're actually recording after all this time. I thought my computer was just going to literally melt. I think it's going, Sean. I think it's in its death throes.
That's not good. At first, I thought you were talking about your MacBook, which I was concerned because it's relatively new. But it makes sense because you're talking about your iMac and it has a spinning platter in it. And you said it's...
Yep. Fusion Drive. It's 4 years old now. It's 4 years old. So it is... It's getting pretty up there in terms of computer years.
Which is weird to think about now, because when you first started saying it, I was like, 4 years? Well, first of all, it didn't dawn on me that you weren't talking about your iMac, your MacBook. So I was like, 4 years? That doesn't seem like an SSD should last way longer than that. But makes sense. Spinning platter.
Yep. So I'll need to figure out, I guess, what I'm going to do about that pretty soon.
Redundant backups, Paul. Make sure you're testing your backups and such.
Oh, man. I'm assuming that's a reference to the whole GitLab thing, huh?
I'm not firing any shots. I'm just saying, check that stuff. Check it.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. I guess for anybody who doesn't know, and I don't think this is firing shots.
No.
It's a news event. GitLab had some pretty bad outages. Apparently an engineer there ran rm-rf on their Postgres data directory, and it just nuked all their data. So that's not anything from actual repos. So repository data and wikis are still around, but what that got rid of is all issues and merge requests and all kind of like metadata stuff. I don't know how that actually resolved. Did you read about what happened there at the end?
No, I looked at they were streaming on YouTube. They were streaming themselves fixing it. But I watched for a couple of minutes and just went back to what I was doing. So I haven't paid too much attention. I haven't really actually used GitHub. So after moving on from Octopus, all of my new stuff, all my new repositories are on GitHub. So I wasn't actually personally affected by it. So I didn't really follow up to see how that was resolved.
Yeah. Apparently they had 5 backup systems in place at least, and none of those were working as expected. So they were on some fallback backup method last I heard. Pretty ridiculous stuff. That's like, man, that's... Even just reading about it gave me anxiety. That's really a developer's worst nightmare.
Yeah. And especially, it was like hundreds of gigabytes of data. And then the guy that did it realized it pretty quickly. He was like, oh, crap, and stopped it. But it deleted it so quickly. It was just gone, you know? It's pretty wild. So that made me think about how I'm backing my stuff up in the work that I'm doing. And I have a physical copy. I have a drive sitting. I have a 3 terabyte drive sitting on my desk. I'm looking at it right now. And I also I've been using Spider Oak, which is kind of what I've been using instead of Dropbox, but they also allow you to back up different directories. So backing up all my data directories and my user directory and stuff. So a slight moment of paranoia happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Thankfully these days, I mean, I don't even really have to worry too much about backups because the vast majority of my stuff is just in GitHub. So I've got the repos on all of my machines locally, which are fairly up to date, as well as, of course, GitHub itself. So that's pretty redundant as it is. And a lot of other things are just in Dropbox, plus then Backblaze on top of that.
And even thinking about the applications that I work on, Heroku, you know, handles a lot of that for me. You know, I'm using Heroku Postgres, and they have automated backups running and all that stuff. So... being a CT, and this is, I was talking with Kevin last night. I went up to Burlington and I was talking with him, and we were talking about this GitLab thing. And I was thinking about, you know, as a CTO, the reason I was basically explaining to him why I like Heroku so much. And I was explaining to him, like, as a CTO, there are so many things that I have to worry about. And I'm the only developer too. So I have to worry about hardware and software and design and, you know, customer relations and all that stuff. So if I can find a service that allows me to not have to think about things, then that's a win in my book. And for me, Heroku does that because they handle the automated backups. You know, they have a whole system in place for that. You know, I'm sure that they're on top of their game in terms of like making sure those are actually working, right?
Yeah, definitely. And the nice thing, well, hopefully at least, and one of the really great things about Heroku is that it's not just hosting. It handles all your load balancing, which makes scaling easier. It handles all your worker servers. You don't have to worry about setting those up. Database servers are not something you worry about.
Yeah, exactly.
Redis, et cetera, et cetera. There's just so many things. It removes a lot of things that you would otherwise have to be an expert in, or at least fairly knowledgeable in. And it's just when you are one person or a very small team, that's a huge benefit, because then otherwise you can spend your whole time worrying just about your setup instead of actually solving business logic problems.
Well, yeah, and a lot of larger companies, there are entire departments that just do that. That's their job. There's many people that's their job is to worry about the hardware side of things. So,
which is necessary and great.
It's necessary. For sure. And that's why when you find something that saves me as much time as Heroku does, even deployment, like automated deploying, I could figure out Capistrano or something, but I don't have to, you know. It's pretty wild that I can set up myself in like, you know, 15 minutes. And this is how I'm working with DK right now, is that when I PR into master that runs on CircleCI and that passes, it's auto deployed to staging. And it took me maybe 15 minutes tops to set the entire chain up. And then if I wanted to deploy to production, I click one button because of Heroku's pipeline, you know?
You're using the pipelines?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do you like those?
It works great. I mean, it's like nearly instant. So from what I understand, or from my understanding of how it works, is that once it's compiled into your staging, when you click promote, it just takes the compiled slug that you have and just moves it for you. So it doesn't have to rerun all that processing and stuff. So you still have to rerun migrations or something like that, but literally, I mean, it's like a click and 2 seconds later, you've deployed to production.
That's really cool. Yeah, that's very cool. I have a similar system set up. I'm just now in the process, actually, like right before our call, of switching over to the pipelines. But I had something similar in place already, and it's real nice.
It's very nice. There can be some gotchas if you're working with something like. Specifically with Webpack, in my case, for Knight Foundation, I'm using some environment variable stuff, but it can't, that data doesn't live on the server, or those environment variables don't live on the server. They're compiled. When Webpack runs build, it interpolates those into the values. So because when you click promote to production, it just moves the slug. It doesn't recompile things for you. I noticed that if I were to do that, then obviously in production, all of my variables would reference the staging variables, which I don't want.
So how did you get around that? Or have you not figured out how to yet?
I just don't use pipelines.
Okay.
So they said there's like some complicated stuff you can do, but it wasn't worth it. So instead I just pushed to that Heroku endpoint, and it deploys it. But for the most part, it's super nice.
Sure, sure. So early this week, we were kind of talking a little bit about Rails Form Builder. And I think both of us kind of enjoyed that conversation. And I thought it would be kind of cool to maybe talk about a little bit on the show. So basically what we were saying, the gist of it is that, you know, several years ago when I was first picking up Rails and when you were first picking up Rails, Form Builder, all the form building tools seemed just outstanding. It changed the way I wrote web apps. It really, really did. And it's just so funny how quickly everything moves. Because you look at that now, you look at the way Form Builder works versus doing things in something like Vue or React or Angular or whatever. It's like, man, what a strange backwards way to have done things for so long.
Right. And it's great if you're not subscribing to like lots of Ajax and lots of SPA things happening, it works fine still. It starts to really break down when you're kind of trying to do both at the same time. You know, so if you're building out lots of your UI in basically purely Ajax, if you're just bootstrapping with JSON, then you kind of have to leave it behind because they just don't match up very well.
Right. And I mean, there is stuff in the Rails form builders like Remote True where it will actually fire off an Ajax request, and that works. That can be a decent thing, but it doesn't really allow for a ton of flexibility. You are very limited in what you can do there. It's like you listen for an event and then you disable the button, but everything else still pretty much works the same.
And even then, for me, it's a little confusing still. So for me to know how the form processing is happening, I would have to actually look at the button myself and see, oh, remote true's happening. And then I have to know that UJS is a thing that's included, you know, that watches for those data attributes and then basically sets up functionality according to the data attributes that you set. I would just prefer not doing that, and I would just rather handle it myself because then it's explicit. I see it. And I just know, you know, if I'm working in a larger project, I will eventually forget that I maybe did remote true or something, and it'll confuse me, or, you know, it's just, for me, it's all about fighting to maintain my focus, and that something like that will distract me because then I'll start thinking about why did I do this, or is UJS still a thing? And I'll start like Googling, and it'll just distract me, you know?
Right. And well, and it's, in a lot of ways, using Form Builder is sort of a tight coupling between the front end and the back end, or very much a tight coupling. Like it ties things together in a way that having an API-based app where everything is completely abstracted and you can have any client talk to these endpoints, it really is the kind of the best type of separation of concerns.
Right. And I'm seeing this firsthand in Design Collective because half of it is like a server rendered, say like you have an HTML page, and the HTML page just has a view component on it, and then you inject some data into it from the controller. So half the app is like that, and then half of it is like components hitting an API endpoint and getting data that way. And the majority of the bugs I'm finding right now are any weirdness that's happening is either something completely unrelated to the front end at all, or it's related to the fact that there's like this, it's almost like not really, it's almost like a twilight zone, right? So it's like, not really. There's like there's an HTML page that's an ERB page that gets compiled by Rails, but all it does is bootstrap some data and it's tied to a controller somewhere, you know? So then you have things happening in three places. You have the view file, you have the view as in like the HTML.ERB file. Then you have the view component itself. And then there's maybe props, maybe not, that are coming from that. And then there's also the controller. And that's, you know, obviously what's deciding what information gets sent to the view. And so it's kind of spread out into three places, and it can be also very confusing, especially if the naming conventions aren't the same, because then you're just having to, you know, go spelunking through the code base. But it's, for me, it's much, much easier, and it's much easier to keep things consistent, which is what I think is important, to just, you know, forget about having a view page tied to a controller endpoint. And instead, as I'm building out new features, just use the API, because that's what it's there for. And then you don't have to worry about setting up new controllers. You don't have to worry about setting up new view files and remembering those are there.
Right. And I think all this kind of comes back to something that we discussed, I believe, last week, where on this show, a recurring theme for sure has been that we say, really make sure that you know the tools that you're using and don't go to new stuff just because it's new. Make sure that that's going to be solving a problem that you have right now and improving your workflow. And I think this is a great example of when you actually do need to move forward. It's also important to not get stuck to the tools that you are using and recognize when they aren't necessarily meeting your needs anymore.
Right. And I think another big thing is just fighting for simplicity. And I always read, you know, different blog posts talking about how that's a super important thing in programming, is it's really hard to keep things simple. It's really difficult as things grow to maintain simplicity. And so that's what I'm doing. You know, a lot of people might hear me complaining about having a controller and a view file and a JavaScript component all separated. But for me, it's fighting for simplicity. I would much rather have one JavaScript component and one API endpoint to worry about, as opposed to having them kind of spread out, right? It also kind of comes into play all the other stuff I have to do. And I'm thinking about design, I'm thinking about CSS, I'm thinking about my Heroku backups. You know, I'm getting emails from my boss, I'm getting GitHub issues from our guy that's talking with stores who are, you know, submitting feature requests. So the less I have to think about, the less I have to dig around and try to remember about my code, the better off I am.
Yeah. One unexpected benefit for me of having everything broken out into two repos. I have the API and admin interface, and then I have the client, so which is just an API consumer, effectively. But one of the unexpected benefits of that for me is that it's actually made doing some refactoring stuff kind of simpler, I feel like, and easier to break into like atomic pieces. Because then there's no like, okay, so this commit updates this controller output, but it doesn't change how the client works, so you can't really deploy this. now I can just say, okay, this is a set of API changes and this is a set of client changes. And that can be broken up even further however I want. But at that base level, at least I get that separation, which has been really nice for me mentally.
Right. And what I find also helps me in something like that too, because I'm doing that with Watch Nature, is that when I'm working on a project, for example, if I'm working on something for the back end, I tend to try not to think about the front end at all. So if they're coupled together, then you start to conflate issues, you know? So if you're working on an endpoint, you shouldn't really necessarily be concerned with how the client might consume that endpoint. If you're following some sort of spec for your API, if you have kind of like consistency in your API, it should be fine, you know? So I think you're less likely to make changes. You know what I mean? You're less likely to give in to that thought of like, oh, I'm going to help my future self shave off a couple of minutes on an implementation because you're thinking about them both. It just helps me mentally separate the two.
And there are ways to get around sort of that coupling that a lot of people run into. There's things like presenters, for example, would be probably the first thing that would get brought up in a lot of cases. And those definitely do have a place and can be useful, but really that is also adding another layer of abstraction, another thing that has to be kept in your mental model at all times. Whereas just having JSON endpoints that return blobs of data is just, that's just how your app works, right? There's no chance of having some view logic getting intermixed in the controller ever, just because there's no views. And I think that is actually a really powerful thing, because it doesn't even just encourage simplicity, it forces simplicity.
Right. Let the server side framework do what it's best at, and let the client side framework do what it's best at. I think that's the best case, you know, in allowing them, like if you're playing to both of their strengths at that point, right? So Rails is really good at being a great server side framework, you know? And when you remove the view side, when you remove all that stuff from the equation, you're left with something that's really great and really awesome to work with. And on the flip side, you know, Vue and Vue Router, they're really great at building spots, you know? So to me, it makes a lot of sense to let what each side is really good at, let them handle that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Using the right tool for the job is also always very important.
Yeah. I mean, I was talking again, yesterday I was talking with Kevin, and I told him, like, I can't remember, besides Vue, I can't remember the last time I was working on something and thought to myself, like, I'm actually really having fun, not just building the thing, but I'm having fun using this piece of technology. Because I always enjoy the work that I'm doing, but I don't always enjoy the technology I'm using to do that work. In my case, Rails, last week I was like, man, this is enjoyable. This is fun. I don't hate this at all.
Yeah. Rails is really pleasant to write back-end logic in. It really is. But the front-end side of it has always been, even when it was pretty state-of-the-art, like several years ago, Sprockets, when that was added into Rails 3.1, I believe, that was like a big deal. And people were really stoked on that. I was really stoked on that. It was awesome. That was game-changing, because nothing really existed like that. There wasn't, even that recently, there really was just no focus on front-end build tools and front-end build processes. And it's kind of amazing how quickly that's changed, and how quickly we've gotten the ecosystem that we've gotten. And there are certainly things wrong with the JS ecosystem. There are a lot of things I dislike about it. I mean, I'm still using CoffeeScript, for God's sake. there are problems that I have with it. But overall, man, it's a pretty impressive ecosystem.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty amazing. For me, it's just encouraging, because there's always progress and people are always pushing. It doesn't ever feel stale, which is awesome. You know, not that Rails feels stale, but I think the pace in the JavaScript community is almost unmatched. It's pretty wild. I don't really look around anymore and see fatigue. I think I'm over that. I think I'm over like trying to have things my way, and then that's how I want it. You know, maybe I'm just being better at, open-minded isn't the right term, but I see a lot of people like talking about JavaScript fatigue. Like there's like people that talk about it in the sense that, oh, there's just too much to learn. And then there's people that talk about it in the sense of like, there's just so much changing. Why doesn't it stay the same? you know? And for me, it's fun because I'm not plugged into the JavaScript ecosystem as deep. Like, I don't have as much just news streaming into my brain all the time. So now when I peek my head up occasionally and look, I'm like, oh, that's cool. That's a cool development, you know? It doesn't feel quite as overwhelming, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely a thing, is you can be using pretty new stuff. You can be using pretty new tech in JavaScript and kind of just not pay attention to what's going on as much.
Yeah.
You can, like, unsubscribe from a couple newsletters and you'll be fine. Things will still move quickly. And if you want to use some new tech, you're going to have some learning to do, for sure. But you don't have to inundate yourself with these things all the time, because that is really, you're causing your own fatigue when you do that.
Yeah. And you know what? I have two production apps that are running Vue 1.0.28. I haven't even upgraded them to Vue 2, and that's fine because Vue version 1 is still great. I still enjoy working with it. It still solves my problems. It's still fast. I have no complaints, zero complaints about it.
Yeah, Vue 1 is really... it's a solid piece of software still.
Yeah. So I don't know what changed in my mind. I unfollowed a few people on Twitter and unsubscribed from a few newsletters coming into my inbox. But I feel way more at peace about how things are, I guess. Maybe it's that I don't get quite as offended by people having their own opinions and talking about those opinions like that's how things should be. I don't feel like people are pushing stuff on me anymore just because I don't care enough anymore, if that makes sense. I have other fish to fry, right? So why do I care if someone gets mad if I say something and they don't agree with what I have to say, or I don't agree with what they have to say? Like, that doesn't do anything for my life. It has no direct impact on me as a person. So I think maybe that's where the change happened. It was where I took on like a Rails job where I'm like, crap, I should probably learn SQL. I should probably brush up on all this other stuff, and it stopped mattering to me as much. So,
well, and I think that's the thing also that just kind of generally comes with experience, is that when you're newer to something, it's really easy to say, oh no, you know, this, my way is the right way, because you don't know as much and it's scary to be wrong. But I guess, I don't know about you, but I've just accepted that I don't know anything.
Yeah. Wait. I think I said that to you. No, what I said something like, basically I just don't know what I'm doing, right? I said that to you in Slack, and then I screenshotted it and sent it to Josiah, and he thought it was hilarious. And I'm pretty sure it just said, so basically I don't know what I'm doing. But I kind of embrace that. And also, I think on the flip side, now since we keep talking about like going from consulting and greenfield projects to owning something, having to own something. And so I think that's also changed my perspective a lot, in that I got into programming because I liked technology and I liked computers. You know, I didn't get into technology and programming because I wanted to build cool things. That just kind of evolved out of learning. You know, if you're programming, you're building something, so that's just going to happen, right? And I realized that not everyone's story is like that. But for me, I didn't say like, I want to build this thing and I need to learn how to program to do it. So that's my way of getting there. For me, it was opposite. I want to learn how to program because I think it's cool. And now I need to find something to build, right? And so now I've kind of come through that whole phase where I was working for consulting and it was all about the technology. You know, you're just working on different apps here and there. And now I'm on two long-term projects where these are kind of like my babies. These are kind of like my things, right? And now I'm more interested in thinking about how is the end user going to feel about different things? How are we affecting, like, is this a good idea? Is this a bad idea in terms of performance? Before, I was like, all right, well, you told me to do this. I might have concerns, but I'm going to do it. And now it's like, okay, let me like think on the other side, think about the actual product and not so much about the technology. I'm okay with Rails, despite a lot of people maybe like, oh, Node's faster, Elixir's faster, whatever. That's fine. You know, it doesn't bother me because I have my mindset on the other side of it, if that makes sense.
Right. The technology is a means to an end.
Yeah, exactly. And before, technology was the end, because that's what I was chasing and trying to learn. So yeah, it's very interesting, like paradigm shift in my mind. And I think that's also helped me be okay with turmoil around me in the technology world, because I'm just doing my thing now.
Just doing your thing. Computers are hard, man.
It's just a few billion, trillion on and off switches.
Yep. Just so many light switches flicking so quickly. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's amazing any of it works. like even a little bit. Our thanks to today's sponsor, Linode. Go check out Linode today by visiting linode.com/doesnotcompute. If you sign up using the promo code doesnotcompute2017, all one word, they'll give you $20 in account credit to get started.